Welcome to Whiskey Optional at Whiskey and IR Theory. When whiskey is optional, that means we've convened a panel to explore some aspect of international theory. In this episode, that topic is international order. What is international order? Why has it suddenly become a hot topic in international theory? Why does it matter? Is it even a thing? To answer these questions, I'm joined by an all-star lineup. To my virtual right is Professor Evelyn Goh. Professor Goh is the Shedden Professor of Strategic Studies at the Correll Bell School of Asia-Pacific Affairs at Australian National University. To her virtual right is Stacey Goddard. Professor Goddard is the Mildred Lane Kemper Professor of Political Science at Wellesley College and the director of the Madeleine Corbell Albright Institute for Global Affairs. Rounding out our lineup, Kyle Leskeritz. Dr. Leskeritz is an Assistant Professor of International Affairs at Lewis and Clark University. Welcome to Whiskey and IR Theory. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
Evelyn, let's start with you. What is international order?
Hi, Dan. Yes, that's a question I get asked a lot. And obviously, one's got to make a distinction between, you know, that sort of usual use of the word order to distinguish it from disorder, for example, or order versus chaos, for example. You know, that's a general use that you know, tries to get us towards the normative substance of order. It's some sort of condition of peace or the absence of war. That's reflexive use of the word. I come from the tradition of the international society tradition that thinks of order in a more holistic sense, stemming, of course, from Hedley Ball's sort of 1970s idea of international order as a quality of the international system that derives from the fact that we don't just have an international system, but we have an international society that enjoys a degree of rule-governed behavior or norms-governed behavior that gives a certain degree of regularity and predictability in international conduct, that strives towards some degree of shared goals in what he identified as international society, that social element of shared goals. So, you know, when we think about international order, then it really is that sense of there being that duality. Like, yes, you have power, but there are also values and norms. Yes, you have anarchy, but there is also that element of society within that anarchical system. So that's start there, and we can obviously build the layers onto that. But that's the sort of basic notion of order according to what is called the English school, that Boolean definition.
Stacey, is that how you also see international order?
I think I come at it from a different perspective. And a lot of that tends to be network relational. Now, let me actually start by saying that in my own work, I tend to come at it from a lazy perspective, which is to say, I often begin by grabbing Eikenberry's definition of order of settled rules and arrangements that I can't remember if he actually used govern the international system. So in many ways, you know, he's an historical institutionalist, he's not from the English school, but I think that intersects a lot with what Evelyn was saying. But when I unpack it, and if I were to actually take more time and be more careful, I tend to see order as something that ultimately resides in relations among actors. And the way I think about it are stabilities, emergent stabilities in those relations among actors. And more importantly, that those stabilities end up having emergent properties. Right? So they end up actually having causal effects. So we can see stabilities in the actual material relations themselves. So patterns of interactions, more dense interactions, say, for example, in alliance relations or economic relations. And from there, we can get stabilities in the symbolic parts of those networks. Oftentimes, I think of these as stabilities in discourse or narratives, the stories that we're telling about those. And I do think they have constraining effects, to be clear. And I think this intersects a lot with Evelyn's discussion of governance, but not necessarily in the fully intentional sense of governance, if that makes sense. That this is much more kind of almost a post hoc retrospective telling of narrative that ends up creating these type of constraints.
So Kyle, you've written an overview of the concept for the, or you've co-authored an overview of the concept for the Oxford Research Encyclopedia of International Studies. The answers we've just heard are answers that come out of two different traditions. From your perspective, how do they fit within a broader debate about the nature of international order? And what do you yourself think?
Also, great to be with you, Dan. For me, this is hoppy beer and IR theory instead of whiskey, but coming from Portland, Oregon. So I think of international order as needing a two-part definition. And a lot of times I end up thinking that a definition of international order needs both an input side and an output side. And in some ways, what I was hearing from Evelyn and Stacy in their opening comments were Evelyn talking about order as an input, talking about rules or norms or things. And Stacy was talking more about what I think of as order as an output, which is some kind of regularity or stability. And so the way that I think about international order is that baseline definition, the output of order. We don't like to say that order necessarily means peace. That's too simple. But it does seem like order denotes at its core some kind of regularity of expectations, of regular patterns of interaction or behavior. So international order as output, I think, has to be associated with that. And I actually think that most people that talk about international order would agree on that baseline definition, though my colleagues here could correct me if I'm wrong on that. I think where they disagree is the input of that, like what the substance of order that actually brings about that regularity ends up being. So one possibility Stacy mentioned, networks. Evelyn mentioned norms and rules in the English school sense. I think scholars of the realist persuasion would focus more on the distribution of power and have different arguments about which distribution of power is more orderly. John Eikenberry, who was mentioned, associates international order with international organizations or institutions or international law kind of formality. I would say come closest probably to the traditional English school understanding of order, where I think of it as kind of broad-based rules. And I think rules in the most general sense is the most effective way of grappling with the concept, because it allows us to compare different orders over time and space more than a focus on institutions. For example, the modern liberal international order that everybody is supposedly so interested in today certainly is characterized by formal international institutions, but not every system that we would consider ordered throughout history has formal institutions in that way. And so I think of order mostly as rules, broad-based rules about who counts, who are members of this club that ends up being order, and then rules of behavior, that is rules of interaction, how they can interact with each other, what they can and can do, can't do, what is and isn't off limits.
I think in my own work, which, you know, I haven't talked about yet, I probably fall in between where Kyle's come from and where Stacy has. You know, of course, as you've both said, you know, a wide variety of scholars, right, notably the liberal institutionalists, the constructivists, you know, all look at, you know, rules, norms, etc., international relations. But I think for those of us who want to work on order as such rather than rules or norms for their own sake, there's got to be an engagement with two elements. One element is what Carl has called the input, which I think I would rather be, like Stacy, more willing to characterize them as that mass of what we might think of as processes and social things. You know, And without being very explicit about it, I think the traditional English school was distinguished by that. There was a great deal of interest in thinking about how do these norms come about? Whose norms are they? You know, how did they then get spread and accepted by other bits of international society and therefore become this emergent thing that Stacey was pointing us towards, right? The emergent quality of the sum of these social interactions that then gives you that, you know, that thing called order. Yeah. So the English was always been, I think, secretly, not so explicitly, more interested in the emerging of those, or the negotiations, as I call them, of those norms. Of course, that, you know, the English school was very constrained by the fact that it was white, it was European, it was, you know, all those things. It was a product of its time, and therefore took a very sort of, to my mind, rather static one-way look at this. You know, how did the essentially European set of agreed consensus rules and values become then spread to other parts of the world? Of course, these days we can do much more with that basic set of tools without buying into that unilateral or unidirectional assumption. We can do much more in thinking about what I would think of as the negotiation and the contestation that goes into how we agree, what are values that we share, what are norms that ought to govern our relationships. And so in my own work, that's the type of social negotiation that goes into the inputs of order that I focus on a lot, which is where Stacey and I think have quite a lot of common ground. Stacey wants to come in.
No. I in many ways, I just want to build on your points, Evelyn, which is to say that I love the fact that you bring in the fact that if you look at early English school writing, what you get is this discussion of process and contestation, precisely what you're saying. And in many ways, I'd be curious because you're far more the expert and really immersed in this literature than I am. But my sense of it is a few things happen. You know, it kind of takes a turn and becomes married to kind of a sociological institutionalist school and begins to get much more, rather than talking about these processes of order, becomes the order, this kind of institutionalized, homogenous order. And then your second point, I think, is so important, right? Which is it gets married to arguably this very Eurocentric white teleological liberal view, and the order is marching out. So it becomes less about these processes of negotiation and the ordering process, and more about we have this fixed institution that somehow everybody's now getting co-opted into. So I think that's a really good point, that in many ways where the English school was, you know, as it started out, was much more about process and didn't necessarily have the sense of teleology and full-on intentionality that it develops later on.
I just wanted to ask Kyle quickly how fundamental English school theory is to our contemporary discussions of international order, because there's a lot of the typical citations and footnotes from some of the people who write about international order, Eikenberry and others, basically say that the English school is the starting place for a modern theorizing of the concept. Is, in your sense, is that correct? Is that accurate? Is that a good way of looking at it?
So that's a good question. I do think that it's the starting point. I mean, I think that in the history of in the development of IR theory, I think it was the English school theorists that were first seriously grappling with at a time when everybody else was talking about anarchy and really a lack of order, or if there was any order, it was a very implicit order. The English school theorists, and Hedley Bulthold foremost amongst them, was saying, no, there's some larger systemic properties going on here that make it more than just an interdependent system. It's some kind of, whether it's a shared understanding, the norms, whether it's common rules of the road, whether it's institutions, there is something to this. There's something else going on that is worthy of our attention and studying. And so I don't think that, you know, yes, everybody cites the same things in their footnotes when they first talk about international order. I do not think that is a throwaway or unnecessary citation. I think that is the starting place. You know, quite frankly, I think that the study and discussions and conceptions of international order have now at times often perhaps moved away from that, from the English school tradition. And we have some divergent conceptions and understandings of order today, but I think you've got to start with the English school, and I think they've earned that.
Just to follow up on Carl's point, I mean, and what Stacey said earlier, I think we also risk a little bit of a typecasting, right, of the English school sometimes if we just look at that first phase of development. I think subsequent very important phases of development of the English school have been less well read, cited, and seriously engaged with. You know, especially in the US IR literature. And I'd, you know, some of the sort of faults that or outdatedness, let's put it that way, that Stacey and I have both alluded to in the Bull type literature, of course, has been more than adequately addressed. And I think the later subsequent generations of English school theorizing. So, I mean, the one book that I teach off these days, if I teach the English school, is Andrew Harrell's book on global order, right? Which is a much more subtle and much more up-to-date take on the things that we've just been talking about. And, you know, there's also really important work that's been done by people like Ian Clark, who's explored different elements of how we might think about international order by splicing it down and so on and so forth. And then there's those of us who've applied this in different contexts, you know, in regional and you know other what we might think of as traditional, you know, realist geopolitical contexts as well. So the field is very wide these days, I think, even if we just look at English school, self-identifying English school literatures. And I think, you know, that there's quite a big resource there.
I actually wanted to ask Evelyn about this. Part of my I could say difficulty with English school theorizing specifically on order today is, and I try to read as much as possible on new English school work specifically on international order, is I find that order is defined or conceptualized in such an all-encompassing way, it's hard for me to see what is order and what isn't order in English school work now. Order seems so all-encompassing that it's synonymous for the international system or for international relations more generally. And for the sake of being provocative, I'll say I wonder if at times the English school work hasn't made more of a dent in the American study of IR on the question of order, because whereas on the American side, we are having all these debates about, well, is it rules? Is it power? Is it norms? Is it networks? Is it institutions? I feel like sometimes I look at the English school and they say, well, it's all of those things. And it's so much more than that. So, I guess I'm genuinely curious about what you think about this question, and if English school scholars today really do make choices about what is and isn't a part of international order.
Stacey will probably have things to say about this too, I think. But I think you're not wrong, Kyle. I mean, the way you've put it is exactly how I would put it. I mean, you know, if we must use the language, I think the DV is different. You know, American political science tends to want to ask questions that will push you towards answers that will privilege order or norms, right? That's the way the question is asked. Now, if you ask the question that way, you can only have a singular answer at the expense of the other. It's a zero-sum answer, right? But English school scholars, and here I'm generalizing, of course, tend to ask different sets of questions about understanding the nature of international order, for example. Now, if you ask a question like that, then it leads you towards answers that need to be unpacked and that have multiple layers and multiple elements, but doesn't have the binary. So if you ask a question about, you know, what is international order like today as opposed to the 19th century, then you'll have this, you know, answer that encompasses power, norms, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, so part of it is the different DV that is brought to bear. But I think there's also a fair degree of the sense that, apart from the different questions being asked, that actually the more important questions are precisely what we might think of as the systemic questions, which are by nature broad questions about the nature of the international system, right? So if you ask questions about that, you generally are going to have a kind of broader systemic sort of answer, right? No one faulted Morgenthau for writing Politics Amongst Nations the way he did. I mean, that is an impenetrable tome for most people, you know? But it has its sort of uses, right? Then you have the mid-range kind of English school, which is why I was saying just now that there are works which, you know, I think try to reach a mid-range sort of set of questions about international order. So I've done stuff, for example, on looking at, we think about international order, how does that change what we would normally ask as the question about power transition, right? So to contrast, what does an order transition look like rather than a power transition, for example? And this in the context of US-China or in the context of China-Japan, in my case, in East Asia, right? Leads you to some more mid-ranging types of answers that you know, go somewhere in between. You could also ask a series of questions about, you know, if we think about US power, not in the international system, but in an international order, all right? If we privilege the elements of asking the question of what is the US's role in upholding a certain type of international order, right? The work that Dan and John Eikenberry led on thinking about, you know, hegemonic orders, for example. You know, if you shift that and you ask those questions and you use the lens of order instead of system, right, does that lead you to a set of different theories? Which it does. And I think that their project showed it quite well. So I'd say that there is a middle range ground there somewhere that there is work out there. That would be interesting and perhaps more approachable for the American IR audience.
You know, Kyle, I was taken by your question, and in part because of my almost surprising reaction to it, which is, well, isn't then everything international order? And my first reaction was, well, yes, and what's the problem with that? And so let me explain what I mean by that. And I think a lot of what we're talking about goes to Dan's fundamental question about what's your definition, right? So if we start with the idea that order is something that just happens in any social quote-unquote system or social interactions, then order is in fact pervasive, right? I can think of very few moments where one simply has actors with no sense of predictable, meaningful relations, right? To me, this would be the equivalent of two actors unable to communicate, unable to just kind of interacting without any sort of context or understanding of each other, right? So the moment, I mean, this is kind of the fundamental question of when we look at social systems, social interactions, they somehow become order. Now, that doesn't mean that every order has similar qualities, right? And Dan and I have been discussing this for a while. We can think about orders, for example, as ranging along thin and thick, right? From kind of a minimal series of predictable actions, of predictable repertoires, if you will, through which actors communicate, to things that are much more thickly entrenched, right? Institutionalized, fully understood, fully embraced, fully shared, right? So Kyle, I actually think what you're saying is that not everything is ordered in that thick sense of the word, right? And again, I was kind of jotting down, what do I mean by thick? That it's intentional, that actually there is an actor or a group of actors that understand they're engaged in an ordering project for whatever reason, right? That order is somehow, not all orders are normative, not all orders become imbued with a social purpose for the collective social purpose. Some of them have this. I can think about anything from the concert system to the obvious liberal international order. We have a collective story about why this exists, but one can have order without that. But that kind of gets to the point that I think it's actually okay to say that all interactions are ordered or that actors are always engaged in ordering projects and try to differentiate that from this kind of big international order in the way that I think we mean when we say international order.
Kyle, do you have any reactions?
Yeah, both of my colleagues here have made very persuasive cases that I'm learning a lot from them here, and I think they've made a lot of good points. I guess in response to Stacey's comments, I certainly agree to a certain extent, and in fact, in the Oxford Encyclopedia article that Dan has referenced, we talk about a couple of fault lines and kind of traditional fault lines in the study of order. And I think the first one we hit is thin versus thick conceptions of order. So I very much believe in that and understand it. Just to push back on one other part, just a little bit though, when Stacey was talking about order as actors in a social system, I was having a hard time figuring out what distinguishes order from just a system. I understand the system, an international system, to be where there's some basic level of interdependence, where one actor's decisions, have some positive or negative impact on the other actor's system, or the other actor's behaviors and such. And so it just seems to me that order needs to be something more than that. And I keep coming back to rules and whether they're implicit or explicit rules or something about the relations of the actors or on the order as output kind of definition. There needs to be a regularity to that interdependence that a system establishes, because otherwise, if that's order, at least to me, and maybe we're just getting into a semantic back and forth here. But if a system is always ordered, then I'm not sure why we talk about order and we don't just talk about systems and systemic properties all the time. So I guess Stacey, maybe I'm asking you, what do you see order as being something beyond just an international system, or is any international system by definition ordered in some way?
So I will go to the position that any international system is going to be ordered in some way, or there are going to be processes of ordering. And the reason goes to the idea that if you talked about kind of a minimal sense of interaction, and my question there is, okay, so let's get into those interactions. How are they occurring, right? I think, and this is a little off the topic of order, but it keeps occurring to me as we're talking. I think about Tom Schelling's distinction between the use of brute force and the use of coercion, right? And the idea that in one of these, I always demonstrate to my students by the difference between me asking for your pen and me going over and just ripping it from your hands, right? If we're going to move to even that kind of primitive second step of interaction, right, we need to have some basis of ordered communication. We need to have some basis of shared meaning and understanding. Now, again, I'm not saying that that is thick. I'm not saying that that's somehow meaningful, that we have any sort of shared identities, right? But that becomes kind of the meaning of order. And it's actually a little perplexing to me because, when I think about the basis of order or discussions of order in sociology, one would never say system without also including some sort of idea of how a system is ordered, right? And then I even go to waltz. Again, it's something that's really simple. And it was going to say simplistic, but let's say simple. What his interest in is how this system becomes order. Now that order is recurrent balances, right? But it actually talks something about the mechanisms that create those type of recurrent balances over time. I think what we're interested in here and what we're asking is the extent to which when these really thick orders happen, the ones that are intentional, the ones that have a social purpose, are those qualitatively different than what's going on in ordering processes in thinner systems? Or is there something that's occurring on a continuum where it actually makes sense to talk about the causality in a similar way, right? In one of these cases, if we actually think, no, these thick orders are something completely different, they're institutionalized, they're shared identities, they're shared norms, then we're basically saying, we need a complete, let's go out and find different theoretical frameworks because this is really different. If we're thinking that actually this is all kind of stemming from some sort of interactions and narratives about those interactions, the ways in which meanings get embedded, so on and so forth, we're actually talking about, we can use a similar theoretical framework, whether or not we're talking about thin or thick orders.
Carl, I sympathize with your question because it's one that I struggled with, but from the other side, right? For a long time, I guess because I was trained in this tradition, and you know how many things are implicit when you're trained in the tradition, then you have to go back 20 years later and try and unpack it and see if you actually believe it. You know, it always occurs to me that fundamentally it really comes down to whether the difference between system and order, it comes down to the degree to which we want to be really, really explicit about the sociality of international life. Right, it's the social, not necessarily the way the sociologists take it for granted, right? Because we're political scientists, and for us, we need to make a bit of a step, you know, to make this operationalizable for us. And so the way I sort of, in a very unsatisfactory interim way, thought about this in my own work is to say, okay, if we think about a system, right? You know, we have the existing tools from IR, right? We think about structures, we think about actors, we think about the things that you know, you sort of talked about. And then I ask myself, okay, well, if I'm very, very explicit about the sociality, what would I be focusing on instead, you know? And I came up with these three things in my own work because, you know, I work on, I guess, the thicker side of what Stacey is talking about, right? Sorry, Stacey, brain freeze there. The thicker side of, you know, great power rivalries and bargains is kind of where I come from. So that's fairly thick because one looks very hard for the sort of observable elements of that ordering in those relationships. When I think about the sociology, sociality of this, then I end up emphasizing things like, you know, it's about an explicit social exchange between the US and China, right? Rather than what, you know, IR theorists tended to say, which was it was about looking for absolute or relative gains. What do I mean by social exchange? I had to think about this myself. And so I've been working for some time now on variations of social compacts, you know, between great powers, for example. I think that's a better device if we want to sort of really be very social about our analysis, right? Because if you ask about what is the social compact, then you're obliged to ask about what is the mutual understanding here about what's going on? You know, what's the reciprocity in our relationship? What am I offering you? And what am I looking for in return? They're not necessarily fungible things, right? But they're very social things. And the gains framework doesn't let you get at that the way, you know, the asking about a bargain, the social compact thing lets you get at that. Similarly, I tend to work with social structure rather than what we would usually think of as international structure. So if you ask, what is the social structure in this order? Then it leads you more naturally to think about who's in, who's out. What kind of members are there? How many layers of membership are there in our international order? You know, what do these layers of membership mean in terms of position, status, you know, distribution of authority, bases of authority? You know, again, it opens up these questions which are a bit different. It lets us think about power relationships rather than power distribution, which comes to where Stacey was coming from earlier about social relationships, right? So that's what I've tended to find a little bit helpful if I were very explicit about the social But it is a bit of a challenge to think about then how do you operationalize that sociality? I think that's where the challenge is. And I'm obviously talking about the thicker orders, orderings at Stacey's end of the spectrum.
I'm going to throw a few things out and see if I can get you to react to them that I think are related to what you all have been talking about. So early on, Kyle mentioned the distinction between inputs and outputs of order. And what that brought to mind for me is Shipping Tong's essay on international order, in which he argues that order is predictability, and that all the rest of the stuff that we're talking about, norms, power, coercion, social structure, are potential ways that produce predictability. And he argues very stridently that we have to separate the two, that we have to distinguish between things that might contribute to regularities and then just order itself. And I think this is a position that certainly I mean, it sounds like Evelyn and Stacey are troubled by, in the sense that I would say I have trouble understanding what the regularity is in the absence of some of those things that are supposed to be inputs rather than outputs. But I'm also troubled about my own answer in the sense that I do think that there is a certain analytical precision to that position that I worry might be important. The second thing, and it's related to this, is that I have this gut instinct that international order is essentially a vehicle for us to be relitigating, not unproductively, but to be relitigating the so-called paradigm or isms debates, that essentially we're arguing about very similar things that we were arguing about in the late 80s, early 90s to the early 2000s, about the sociality of international politics, about the relative importance of norms and rules in constituting international relations versus capabilities, about whether fundamentally somebody like Waltz is right in that in anarchical orders, there is no other source of variation other than capabilities. And I wonder whether that's just, in your opinion, that's wrong, whether it's right that it doesn't matter.
I absolutely agree with you that I think we are, for better or for worse, the order debate involves a relitigation of the paradigms war. And I think that that is a product of the reason that we're gathered all here today for this conversation in the first place, and that's the ambiguity of what international order is. So for whatever reason, probably a variety of reasons, people think that order is a hot topic today, and it's something that we're talking about more and debating more than at least we were a few years ago. But what I found is that everybody brings their own definition and conception of order to the table, and oftentimes it breaks down along paradigmatic lines. So to simplify things a little bit, the realists think order is the distribution of power plus the generally anarchic nature of the system. Constructivists focus on norms and intersubjective understandings. Institutionalists talk about institutions, and so on. And so, I don't necessarily have a good answer for this, except whenever I try to conceptualize order and talking about it before is kind of a baseline definition of an output and then what the input is. The reason that I like rules isn't because I think that that's the magic best solution and captures everything that I want to say about order, but it seems like it's the most analytically neutral place where we could get a conversation going. And even though Stacey and Evelyn haven't emphasized rules perhaps to the degree that I have in this conversation so far, when you're talking about things like basic social understandings, I mean, I tend to think that we're talking about common basic baseline understandings of coexistence that seems to get back down to rules. But anyways, Dan, I think you're very much right about this has opened the paradigmatic Pandora's box once again.
Ben, I think you're right too. But I think that the reason why we're relitigating this and we're choosing the court of international order in which to relitigate this is because the last paradigm wars were not comprehensively won by one side or the other. And that we actually ended up in a very unsatisfactory armistice in the last paradigmatic wars, because the armistice was one that gave us this binary, you know, that Carl just described. And the International Order Court of Litigation helps us, I think, because there is a prospect here in the international order lens of coming to, I think, a more usable answer to this paradigmatic war that takes into account the reality that it is both power and norms, right? But doesn't just stop there. That's not the interesting answer. The interesting thing that goes on from there is, okay, we accept that it's both power and norms, but how can we usefully do social science with that insight? That's the challenge. Now, the previous paradigmatic wars ended with us saying, well, you're either power or norms, and then go and do your own stuff in each of these silos, which is deeply unsatisfactory on every front. So the other thing, I think, it's a proxy fight. But the real fight is about how do we actually do useful work without that binary, you know, somewhere in the in-between reasonable space that actually anyone who works on anything in the real world knows we must reside in. But perhaps I'm pushing this a bit far because of my own prejudices.
Evelyn, can I actually ask about your optimism? Because I agree with you, right? That in many ways, the nice thing about relitigating this, I like this in the court of international order, is it seems almost apparent that you cannot possibly say, okay, we have order over here and power politics on the other, and they are two separate things and we will keep them apart and we don't have to talk to each other, right? I agree. You've sold me. And yet I feel like there's lots of literature that continues to relitigate this, right? I even think, you know, to Dan's point about Shipping Tang's things, like, okay, we know that this is stability. Okay, but now let's step down and break out the variables and see what really matters here, right? So I hear you and I agree. Is this really where we see the field is going? That there is a, well, that divide didn't work. So now can we get back in a room and think about how we talk about power politics and international order?
I don't, maybe I'm being uncharacteristically optimistic for someone in middle age. I know that, you know, I'm at that age where I'm supposed to be cynical. But I guess, you know, because I work on US-China relations, because I work on the Asia-Pacific, because because I interact so much with non-academic audiences who want to talk about international order, I can't help but feel that it's not optimism. I feel that we have to. We actually, as a field, have to rise to this challenge. We're living in a time when the comfortable binaries are clearly insufficient. Not only that, they're clearly dangerous, outright dangerous. And if IR as a field is... it's going to be not just a product of its milieu, but something that actually looks beyond it and offers some sort of, you know, viable thinking for the challenges of not just today, but tomorrow as well. Then I don't think we have a choice. You know, and yes, we fight paradigmatic wars, but we've got to fight them with an eye not to yesterday's battles or today's battles, but actually the battles of the next decade and preferably the next century, right, in some ways. And if you sit in the Asia Pacific today, this imperative is very real. You know, we can't have a situation in which IR scholars have nothing to say about, you know, the biggest questions that dog this region. And the biggest questions are usually along the lines of, you know, what's going to happen to this the previous international order that was led by the United States that most people and most states in the region actually secretly rather prefer, but are also semi-secretly really worried, you know, has not only declined, but doesn't actually have a future, right? And the reason why international order is that court of litigation is because that is the question that is on the minds of anyone who has to operate in the strategic realm today. And, you know, so we must engage in that court as IR scholars. Otherwise, we'd be totally irrelevant to the most important strategic questions of the day.
I just wanted to ask my colleagues here, and Dan, obviously feel free to answer this as well if you'd like, but why we all seem to agree that international order is a hotter topic today than it was a while ago. And I certainly know this from experience, just because I started in the early days of writing a dissertation on international order, nobody cared. And fortunately for me, by the time I was finishing up and writing a book, suddenly it was the hottest topic in the world. But why do we think that if the paradigm wars have been filtered through this, why international order? Why now? What is it that we are observing about the world that has suddenly made a concept that was there and has been there for decades, suddenly we decided that we needed to take it from the back of the shelf, dust it off, and relitigate our battles through it? I'm curious what everyone thinks.
It's because for a few decades, we enjoyed this thing, which we now know I call the interregnum of US hegemony. In the post-1990, the sort of three decades after 1990, the end of the Cold War, we had this interregnum in which we had an order that largely, I'm not saying every part of the world, but largely most of the world felt it could live with, and it wanted to live the dream of. Okay. And the reason why international order is an obsession these days is because it's patently obvious that that dream, that order, is unsustainable and is pretty much, it depends on where you are in the world, but it's dead to some people, it's dying to others, it's declining to others, but it's very clear that it's under question. And so that's what I meant by, you know, in my part of the world, every policymaker, every scholar who works on international relations has viscerally latched onto questions about international order. And they're not asking questions about the international system. This is really interesting. They're not asking questions about the international system. The lexicon is order, right? And it's tied, it's really intertwined with the end of American hegemony. And there is that normative element to this flocking to the court of international order.
Yeah, to jump on this in two different directions. And first, I want to tie this back to how this becomes tied to the paradigm debates, using Evelyn my status as well as a middle-aged academic. I will go back to the 1990s and I think about the end of the Cold War. And if you think about the ways in which the paradigm debates played out in that, right, you had on the one hand, and I'm going to obviously, you know, stylize this here, but you had on the one hand, the kind of more liberal optimists, right? There are these institutions, NATO will expand, we'll expand the GATT systems into the WTO. And so this is a growing system of governance. And then on the other hand, and obviously I'm speaking to be clear to American IR, you had what we call maybe the realist Cassandras. You know, it's all going to fall apart. It's back to the future. Germany is going to declare a war really any day now. So you had that kind of sense that's going on. And I think for a while, along with the optimism of, say, the American policy realm, right, we're really building this order, you had kind of an ascendance of this is the way the world works and it looks far more liberal. So I think as it became clear that we're going to have a power transition, we're going to have some arguments and contestation around these rules, the more this kind of created space for the reemergence of this paradigm wars, the kind of, we said it was going to happen. We didn't give you a date, but we said it was going to happen. So here we are. So now we're going to have to relitigate it. So just, I'll try to rush through this, but that's briefly point number one. But Evelyn, to your point about the stakes of it, you know, and I know that others here have done this as well, that this is obviously, this is the language of American policymakers as well. It's very much about what's the future of the order, whether it's now the liberal order has become rule-based order. And to the point about breaking down this distinction, the stakes of breaking down the distinction between power, politics, and order, I think that there's a fair amount of effort among academics to say, look, you can have contestation. It's not surprising that China is going to contest the rules of the order. This is the least shocking thing ever. It doesn't mean that this is an all-out assault on liberal democracy. It does mean that we're going to have to think about contestation within the order more and more, that we should expect power politics within an order. And in some ways, I feel like there's almost this attempt now to push back. Like, no, it's not a revenge. It's not an attempt to overthrow it.
Yeah, which is why the order lens is useful, I think. Well, it's useful and it's not useful. Because the shorthand way in which it's been used, particularly in the American discourse, right, is coming back to, you know, where we began, is to say that, you know, order is the lack of chaos. And the lack of chaos is defined by American dominance, right? A liberal order, right? Norms and friends that we can recognize and be comfortable with, and which is always peaceful. Now, anything that, you know, upsets that norm is a challenge, right? Which is where we are now. So order has been used, but it has potential, but has also been misused by the vanguard in order to sort of create this very uncomfortable tension in the current debates. And like Stacey, I've said this to every single audience I've spoken to, you know, discomfort is normal. Competition and contestation is normal, right? It's like saying to children, you know, argument is okay. You don't have to come to blows about it, but it's okay to argue. It's normal, you know. Or in my own work, you know, if you look at within orders, resistance is normal. There are no orders. That's why the sociality is important. You know, there are no orders in which only complicit dynamics pervade. There's no such thing. There's always a balance of complicity and resistance in any social order.
I want to apologize to Kyle because I realize that you are outnumbered 3 middle-aged academics to a younger up-and-coming scholar. And I'm not sure that's fair, but I also know that you asked that question.
He's holding his own.
He's doing just fine, the whippersnapper.
He's great.
But I think, I mean, obviously you asked that question and you have your own answer to it, I presume. I mean, I know my answer is not distinctive from Evelyn and Stacey's. I think the fundamental reason is policy bleed through, that policymakers in a number of countries, including the 2 most powerful countries in the globe right now, view international order as an object of power political contestation. So we sure as hell better have something to say about it. And I also think that is one of the reasons why the realist engagement with international order has been a little bit different than it would have been 20 years ago, where it would have been simply, this is not a thing, it doesn't matter at all. It's been more focused on, well, the liberal order isn't so liberal, or something along those lines. But I want to know what you think, right? The reason we're talking about this now, but also, I don't know whether it's because I'm old and middle-aged and I don't read as much as I used to, but I do get the feeling that you can open up articles, excepting the special issue of IO, which throws a wrench into this, but you can open up articles in journals and you'll see a lot of discussion of international order as a thing, right? It's there. People will talk about theories of institutional contestation and how that affects the international order. So it's entered the kind of language of the abstract articles. But I get the feeling that at least in the United States, this is not true outside of the United States, in the United States, a lot of the active theorizing, conceptualization, higher end debates about international order are not happening in the places where they would normally happen. That is, they're not happening in the peer-reviewed journals so much as they're happening in policy-relevant work, in policy work, and then in books, right, which have different kinds of burdens of getting through the peer review process. And so I wonder whether that sense is right or whether it's just my being old and you know, not assiduous enough.
So, I was going to say on the last question, I know I feel like I found out the hard way that a lot of the leading journals don't want to have the conversation about what exactly international order is or different conceptions of it. In that, for years I shopped around a piece trying to reconcile very different conceptions of order into a single definition, and was often, frankly, desk rejected by people saying, "You're trying to solve the entire field here. What are you doing?" And so, you know, I do think that to some extent that those conversations aren't happening, maybe in some places where they should. As far as my own answer to the question of why we're talking about this now, I mean, I think both Stacey and Evelyn talked about this a little bit. I think it's because we think that it's going away, that order is going away, that we recognize that the liberal international order was this great thing, but we only really recognized it as it was slipping away, and we were seeing all of the negative byproducts of that slipping away. And that got me thinking about, as my colleagues were talking here, it just got me thinking about whether that's true of all of the major kind of factors that IR theory has looked at in prior decades. So it seems like we started talking a lot about hegemony when fears of U.S. decline in the 1970s, for example. Not all of, but a lot of the international institution scholarship seemed to come up when we were identifying problems with these institutions or great powers no longer cooperating in them as they had in previous decades. Soft power seems to have been a benefit of American hegemony that was only really discovered and lauded as, on the other hand, the critique was made that the U.S. was squandering its soft power. So part of me wonders if this is what our field does. We discover good things and collective goods and sources of stability and prosperity and cooperation only in the rearview mirror. And that's when we get fascinated with them and study them. But that is my impression about why we're talking so much today about international order, because policymakers and academics think that we had a good thing for a while that is slipping away, or perhaps has already slipped away.
Then on the part of your question about where in the academic outlets this debate is occurring, I think I agree with you. A lot of the journal publications on that relate to international order seem to me to be, a bit partial and somewhat superficial. And part of it, I think, may have to do with the way the field has gone, right? Carl's anecdote about being told that he's trying to solve the problem of the whole field, you know, it really gives us a sense of, that trend that I personally find very disturbing of, you know, looking to publish a certain sort of thing only, right? I mean, coming out of the English school tradition again, you know, there has never been a sort of disadvantage to somebody who wanted to do systems level work, let's put it that way, right? Or order level work that's been regarded as difficult to do and a worthy enterprise. But you're right, the outlets that would be favorable towards enterprises like these have shrunk, you know, certainly in journal terms over the years. And because I co-edit the Cambridge series in international relations, you know, my experience with that is that yes, you know, the book length treatments of these themes, have tended to be more useful in that sense, or certainly have seen the light of day, and so that's kind of where it's occurred. I agree with you, Dan, but I fear that that's actually more a reflection of this deeper problem that we've had in the IR field for a while, of pressing towards, I don't know what we would call it. Some people call it mid-range theorizing. I don't think that's actually the right characterization. A certain bias towards a certain type of approach, you know, the cookie cutter, here's my 2x2, you know, and it is a problem. I agree.
Just listening to this book, and to be clear, I think there have been good journal articles on international order, things certainly that I've read quite recently in the last couple of years that I'm like, this is really enlightening. This does a lot of what we've all been talking about here, you know, kind of using this question to decimate the difference between power politics and ordered politics. So for that, I do think there's something there. So I don't want to completely to say that it, you know, it's completely a desert out there. But at the same time, I've certainly encountered people, editors at journals, who've been like, I don't want to see anything on the liberal international order. And I think my question is, why is that? And I think there's a sense that among some that's like, well, that just gets us back. Talk about the paradigm debates. That invariably is going to get us back to abstract IR theory with no connection to reality, with no connection to actual, in quote unquote, empirical puzzles. And we need to kind of push beyond this now. It was fine. We could do this for a hot second, but now we need to get back to the business of social science. And for all the reasons here, I think this is unfortunate. What really kind of boggles my mind is I think there is this pushback. And at the same time, and I feel like I'm repeating myself, if you sit in a room with policymakers, this is the question they're asking. So on the one hand, I feel like the dismissal comes from this place of, well, this isn't really concrete. This really doesn't get to it. I'm like, but we're all in rooms with people who want to know about these orders. So maybe this is actually something that should be appearing more in our journals.
There's also the flip problem. Sorry to cut in like that, but there's the flip problem. I mean, I've sent numerous things to review, which are empirically based, that want to look at, you know, challenges to the existing order and so on and so forth, you know, usually in Asia. But they are so thin on the conceptualization of order that, you know, that they're not useful, you know, because they're making lame assumptions about order always being liberal, for example, or so on and so forth, and don't make any effort to engage with, you know. So there's the flip problem where they then seem to want to, you know, publish, or journal editors seem to be interested in publishing real world stuff too, but this stuff it's not underpinned by conceptually useful frameworks that could give us, you know, novel insights into the empirical material otherwise. So it's a dual problem.
I'm glad I'm not the only one who's driven a little crazy by the occasional definition or conception of order, which is a restatement of certain features of late 20th century U.S.-led liberal order, as if that is international order writ large. One of the things that I kind of hear going on that's sort of backgrounded, I don't know whether it's, might just be my imagination, is a little bit of a allergy towards talking about international order as a big aggregate thing. Now, I've heard a lot of discussion about regional order. In practice, what we've actually been talking about regional orders, about the idea that the experience of international order in Asia is different than it might be if you're hanging out in North America. And I'm wondering what we think about, or what you all think about, this question about levels of order, or geographical distinctions of order. How do we think about different dimensions of international order?
This is one that I'm still struggling with, I don't mind admitting. And within the Asia-Pacific context, of course, the thing that drives me crazy is the trope that keeps getting trotted out these days, you know, that, oh, we have a security order that is underpinned by the United States, and then we have an economic order that is underpinned by China. As though these things were discrete. You know, as though American hegemony wasn't foundationally built upon economic hegemony, you know, or, you know, as though China's economic rise has no impact on its strategic and military projection, you know, capabilities, et cetera, et cetera. So the big struggle I have with these issues is that I think we can think in terms of regional orders as a bit of a way to think about characteristics that may distinguish some regions from other regions. Okay, I think that's okay, because clearly there are some distinguishing characteristics in each region. But that can't come at the expense of then saying that there's no such thing as an international order, or there's no such thing as what paradoxically I might call systemic order more largely at the international level. I think these two things coexist. And if you want to use the suborder device, that's okay. But if you want to then at the same time deny the systemic order reality, then that for me is not okay. So that's the one on regions. But my real struggle is the one on domains. You know, can we really separate domains in that cozy, comfortable way that people seem to want to? And my instinctive answer is no, but I haven't found a really good way to operationalize this yet. And I'd be really happy to hear suggestions for how.
I'll stay seated. I don't
see any reason why order can't travel from the truly international systemic to the regional level. And I'm not uncomfortable at all with saying that there can be different levels of order present at any given time. I think it's fine to say that, you know, the states of Europe are members of the global liberal international order, but at the same time, there is a more exclusive European order that has its own additional set of rules or principles. And you know, I think that goes for, you know, other regions of the world as well. And maybe they don't all have to be regional either. They could just be sub-international, not universal orders, you know, of the highest level. So you know, I do think that's okay. I struggle with the point that Evelyn brought up about, on the one hand, I absolutely share her frustration at times with separations that get put up between you know, different issue areas and saying that they're the same thing. On the other hand, it does seem like sometimes it's analytically useful to be able to distinguish that different levels of order, different types of order can exist in the same system of actors. For example, I don't know if you all have read or are familiar with, I think it was in maybe 2019 that Alistair Ian Johnston had an article about China in a world of orders. And he was asking the very good question about everyone talking about China defying the international order. Well, I want to actually try to empirically test that. And what we come down with is different people mean different things about the liberal international order. And I was with him on this and I said, yes, this is great. I'm going to love this. And then he cut it down, I think, into like 8 different issue areas and said the liberal order is 8 orders. And I said, ooh, no, that's too many. 8 is too many. I don't know how many I want, but I don't want 8. I don't just want 1, maybe 2. So maybe somewhere between 4 and 6 is enough orders, but 8 seemed like too many. But that article for me and the whole journey that I went through reading it and loving and not loving certain parts of it kind of represent to me this problem about conceptualizing order and how much we want to separate out individual issue areas from a larger thing that's going on.
Yeah, I think this all comes to the point of what. So first of all, I think that orders are heterogeneous. I think there's lots of friction within normative orders. So for example, you would never say there's one normative order, right? There's going to be a lot of tension and friction. So I think the question is, why do we want to do that? To my mind, it's actually to explore and think about the friction and how that opens up space for contestation. My concern and frustration, which I think Evelyn and Kyle both articulated really well, is the impulse to say, okay, we know that there's that orders are heterogeneous. We know that there's all this friction. So what we're going to do now is classify it as multiple homogeneous orders. I'm like, what? That's what we're going to do? So it's like there's this impulse to suddenly, well, if it's order, it has to be homogeneous. So I'm now going to contain everything. Like, no. Why don't we do the other thing where we say all orders have friction within it and then work from there, right? So I get the point. I really like the point that there are always going to be a multiplicity of orders. We can say, I think, as both Evelyn and Kyle have said here, that there's a dominant order. And at some point, there are more global orders, right? But then to segment it based on the idea that there's just one set of dynamics, that I don't understand why that's theoretically useful. I think in some ways, it misses the interesting questions.
I just wonder, though, whether there are two different dimensions to this. There's a question of whether or not different issue areas that we might plausibly describe as order are causally interdependent. You know, so, well, China underpins the economic order of East Asia, and that has no effect on the security order is a ridiculous proposition. It's probably ridiculous to say that China alone anchors the East Asian economic order as well. But there's all, so the one question is kind of, what are the interdependencies? And this could be even as crude as, you know, the wager that ultimately the rest of order is contingent upon the distribution of power in the security arena, right? Which would be the kind of classic hegemonic stability claim. Then there's the question about whether policymakers and actors experience orders as distinct and treat orders as distinct. So whether or not they, and there might be not only variation across time and across order on that issue, but there may be variation across space. You know, so some of the kinds of frictions and dynamics that might occur in liberal order might have to do with some states and their leadership and their diplomats seeing things as connected or not capable of being decoupled, while other actors might see them as decouplable. Right.
I think you're absolutely right, Dan, on that last point. And for me, this is the source of my dissatisfaction and frustration with, you know, that desire to separate out a security order and an economic order. It's precisely in the Asian context that that impulse to separate comes usually from outsiders, right? Because it's analytically more convenient. And then they can pose zero sum and binary questions on the back of that, right? But when you look at how policymakers within the region, the ones who actually, right, will be the battleground if there is a war, or the ones who actually have to live with China as their immediate neighbor, these policymakers do not think about these realms as separate. In fact, what is really interesting in all the Asian case studies is precisely how they, in different ways, think about the security and economic realms as intertwined, but they do it differently. Those are the interesting research questions. So for me, you know, I guess my frustration, thanks, this is helpful, because I guess my frustration comes from that this juncture, right, of outside extra-regional players and analysts trying to impose these renewed sets of dichotomies on regional realities. And regional empirical data, therefore, that then once again has to be artificially shoved into these binary categories when they're not binary in nature. But that's just a bigger frustration that I generally have, you know, with regional studies. But we don't need to go into that.
I mean, Kyle, you've looked a lot at the kind of overarching literature, and I know this is a little bit unfair. Please report back to us. But what is your sense of how the literature shakes out on these kinds of questions? Are there clear camps? Are there a range of views that are discernible?
You can't see me shrugging because it's audio, but imagine that I'm shrugging.
Yeah, I mean, I actually, in the article that we've referenced a couple times that I co-wrote with Michael Posnansky, we enjoyed writing this and trying to find commonalities in literature. We frankly struggled quite a bit because the reason perhaps I responded so strongly and agreeing with you on the relitigating the paradigm wars question earlier was because it does seem like this is international order is a topic where people are like uniquely capable of talking past each other very, very quickly because the rules of the game are my article's about international order. Here are the details. I have a very specific conception of it. I will cite something, but I will not necessarily, I probably won't engage in a good faith effort to engage with the debates and the different conceptions of it in the literature. And I'll go from there and I'll ask my kind of middle range questions about order from there. So, you know, we did find it really hard, fun and, but challenging to kind of put different scholars and different pieces of scholarship into different camps on international order. But we really did try to do this. And I guess one of the biggest divides that I see, or one of the biggest kind of camp differentiations in order, and I'm actually interested in everybody's opinion on this, it's come up, is whether order has to be intentional, whether there have to be orderers, or whether those that are being ordered have to be conscious of an order being created. Does there at least have to be one overriding orderer? And we differentiate this in the piece between a divide, an explanation that orders have to be intentionally created, or they can be spontaneously derived. That is, you know, a system effect where no one actor intended for an order to come about. And yet we find ourselves in an order nonetheless because of the product of our collective actions adding up to something that is ordered. And I will say, I confess that I used to be more agnostic about this and say, yes, they are both orders. But in the course of writing and talking about orders and even listening to you all talk about orders here, I'm coming around to the view that there is something different about the intentional orders, and that when policymakers talk about order, they are not talking about the spontaneous creation of orders like Waltz and neorealists talk about how balances of power form, without communication and kind of working together on it. And just one example by way of conclusion here, a lot of my work deals with the so-called liberal international order. The United States was influential in building after World War II. And then people like John Eikenberry, though he's not the only one that has done this, but say, well, actually, the liberal international order was one thing, but at the same time, the Cold War itself was a kind of order. And that's when I say, I kind of bristle at that, and I say, no, that can't be the case. If order can be both the liberal international order and all of the kind of rules and institutions that we've all come to associate with that, and order can also be the Cold War itself and something that includes the United States and the Soviet Union for all of their differences and a lack of cooperation and common understandings of things, then if we're going to accept both of those things under the umbrella of order, I'm back to wondering how useful the concept of order is to begin with, because it seems like not that there wasn't something going on between the US and the Soviets, but whatever it is seems so different from this thing that we're calling the liberal international order, that I'm wondering if the spontaneous and intentional order camps are so far apart that they're actually talking about different things.
But isn't one of the features of the Cold War the unusual existence of a global setting in which there were international orders that were highly decoupled in many ways from one another? Right. So the Comecon Warsaw Pact system was not hermetically sealed, from the liberal order. And indeed, by the 80s, you have IMF loans and things like that. But it was substantially disconnected from it, deglobalized, to use the current language. But there were also lots of ways in which the US and the Soviet Union and their allies developed mechanisms and practices, both formal and informal, to mediate their relationships, to stabilize their relationships, right? So I guess I'm not sure that this is a spontaneous versus non-spontaneous question. I think the question is really about the concept of liberal order and how extensive it is, not the question of international order.
Dan, I'll just say very quickly, I agree with what you're saying, but I think we are talking about different things a little bit. What I was taking issue with was not the fact that there were other orders that existed alongside the liberal international order. And I in fact do think that the Soviets had an order in their sphere of influence with their states. What I was contesting was that the Cold War itself and the relationship between the United States and the Soviets was itself a kind of order on a global scale. And I understand that it was an international system, but I just see U.S.-Soviet dynamics, any system that included both of them at the height of the Cold War, as being so different than either the liberal order or kind of the Soviet order in their sphere, that I wonder if that doesn't all belong under the same umbrella of a concept of international order.
I think I understand your question, Kyle. And I'll confess to not having the same conceptual problem with it, because if I had to characterize it, then I would, I guess, say that, you know, the systemic order was the thing that is the Cold War. And for me, that is an order, not a system, because there were very clear elements of it which were socially negotiated. There was definitely, you know, a superpower bargain, that not a static one, but one that involved constant negotiation between the U.S. And the Soviet Union. So, you know, for those reasons, there was an identifiable order, according to how I would think about order, but that was at a systemic level. And of course, the fact that there were two spheres of influence or sub-orders, the Comecon and the American one, was a characteristic of this systemic order. So then if we want to use a sub-order device, we can then look at each of these as sub-orders within the systemic order. It's how I would reconcile it in my mind. But I can see your difficulty. But I think still that may be the order sub-order question. But your other question was actually about intentionality in orders. And on that one, I think that's a really interesting question, to which, again, I think I have an in-between take on it, for the reason that orders are social. So as in all social interactions, there will be intentional, deliberate elements, all right? There will be points, for example, when great powers sit down and negotiate a peace settlement at the end of a systemic war. We're very lucky we have that, because then we can use that peace settlement, right, as a way to gauge the broad outlines of, you know, areas of consensus about social purpose in the international order. We had that at the end of the Second World War, for example, for vast swathes of the system, not all of it, but some of it. But that's not the only way in which order is created. That is an important way, but it's not the only way. A lot of the time you have order as an emergent property, which I referred to earlier, out of the kinds of things that Stacey, you know, was talking about, as the accumulation, the unintended, not directly intended consequence of the accumulation of repeated, reiterated social interactions, right, that give you this emergent thing. And I think it's both. I'm sorry. it's that thing again. I think it's both, you know. And so when I looked at the post-Cold War U.S. hegemonic order in the Asia-Pacific, for example, I did not have that beautiful peace settlement at the end of the Cold War. One could not do an analysis that would give you in very clear terms what the new social compact was that underpinned the US hegemonic order. We had to look at other data points and other processes of negotiations that gave me a sense of what it was that gave the US the kind of consent, you know, consent on the ground, that gave it the followership that then created this order. And so in many ways, it was kind of that emergent property. And it was at times intentional and at times non-intentional. A lot of it was the cumulative consequence of rather individual selfish decisions on the parts of, you know, the ROK, Japan, other Asian actors, even China. That's what I mean, but I think it's a combination. Sorry.
Stacey?
Yeah, I mean, lots of thoughts on this. I mean, I guess the first one in an unfair way is I kind of want to push it back on Kyle and say, what would it be if it's not an order, right? And in other words, would you just simply say, well, can't we just call it bipolar and call it a day? And that's where, you know, I agree with Evelyn. We're not talking about this as being a thick, intentional order with a declared social purpose. But for me to understand the interactions between the United States and Soviet Union, or more specifically between the United States kind of led order at that point and the Soviet led order, without understanding some sort of, having some sort of conception of regular, predictable interactions that are also, they're not random, they're actually marked by common understandings. You know, and I can think of anything from, you know, really good work on the formation of nuclear deterrence, which, you know, people point out that itself is a social order, right? The understanding of what deterrence is supposed to do. To I was actually, you know, just talking to Austin Carson recently about his work about secret wars and kind of these modes of, yeah, you see us intervening, but we're all going to pretend this isn't happening, right? I mean, this is an ordering process. Now, to be clear, Kyle, I agree, that's not the same thing as liberal order, right? We need to have some sort of way of distinguishing them, but I think it's important. I don't lose the meaning of the concept by beginning to talk about this in terms of the Cold War and these two systems. So that's number one. On the question of intentionality, I think this goes to the point, and again, maybe this is what distinguishes, part of what distinguishes these thicker orders, is at some point, some actor or some group of actors declare intentionality and declare a social purpose. Now, to be clear, I actually am very suspicious of the idea that the declaration of intentionality and social purpose means that's the cause, right? I don't think that declaration means, and I will it into being. I think ultimately this is a story that's being told about these interactions and how they've emerged. Like, well, no, it was coherent. And it has a social purpose, right? Right? But there's going to be that moment that makes it something that's different and thicker.
So we need to wrap up soon, but I have to get a question on the table, and I'm sorry. I apologize in advance for this question. So if we were talking about international order in 1995, when I was in grad school, if, say, you were at Columbia in 1995, 1996, talking about international order, there is no way you would not be talking about the nature, character, and variation among the actors that populate international politics as part of international order. But our discussion so far has been extraordinarily state-centric. And I'm curious whether that's just a function of the kinds of international orders we're dealing with empirically, whether it's a function of just, you know, it's a conversation that goes in a particular direction, or whether there is something about contemporary debates about international order that have lost that dimension. And should that dimension be there? And how would it be there if it was?
Dan, could you clarify, are you talking about the presence of other actors?
So, for example, I'm doing international order course right now, and it's actually an international order and state transformation class, because these are two topics that I study and do. But if you read somebody like Hendrik Spruit, right, sovereign state and its competitors, Hendrik will say Gilpin has this definition of these different layers of international order, distributions of prestige, other sorts of things. And one of them, a fundamental constitutive feature of international order, is who gets to be part of international order. right? Sovereign states, empires, city-states, city leagues, what have you, right? Is international art, is actorhood based on principles of sovereign equality? Is it based on principles of subsidiarity or suzerainty, right? These would be fundamental kinds of issues. There would be both the issue of kind of how is status in international order allocated based on actorhood, not just based on some characteristic of the same kinds of actors. But there'd also be these kind of deeper issues about, you know, it's one of the differences between medieval heteronomy as an order and the sovereign territorial state system is who gets to participate as an international, what we'd think of anachronistically as an international actor. My own agenda here is in part that I think it's highly significant that the liberal order is anchored by two federal institutions, the United States and the European Union. And I don't think that you can actually separate out a lot of dynamics that are happening right now in international order from that federative substrata of the linchpin of international order in the Atlantic littoral. But we could look at this in a variety of different ways. We could look at the fact that empires aren't legitimate right now. So even if you are doing literal internal colonial settler colonialism, you don't call it an empire. Right, we could look at whether or not NGOs and which NGOs get a seat at the table at the United Nations. These would be all things that would be traditionally part of a definition of international order. But there's something that we're not talking about, maybe for good reason, or maybe I just want to raise that. Is this something we should be talking about? How does it affect? Does it affect anything that we've said? How does this older kind of conception of international order, which really did focus on the actors in international politics as a fundamental feature of that order, fit into this?
I think there's no doubt. I mean, I was a grad student in 1995 thinking about international order, so I recognize what you're describing. And again, right, the 1995 context was very much shaped also by its milieu, right? That was the immediate post-Cold War decade in which, you know, the rise of the non-state actors was clearly evident on a variety of fronts, right? That this was still, you know, the dissolution of the states and the Balkans and so on and so forth, and where it was necessary to explicitly take into account subnational conflicts and so on and so forth. So part of it was a reflection of that time. I guess what's surprising about us not actually reflecting our current time is that our current time is equally diverse in terms of international actors. And so I agree with that we should be seeing, we perhaps should have actually been foregrounding a bit more non-state actors in a variety of ways. In my own work, you know, if we look at the political economy realm, there's no doubt that it's not possible to talk about, you know, the ongoing economic transitions in the Asia Pacific, for example, by simply talking about states. So you can't do that. You know, networks of regulators are fundamentally important, at least then. Private and other sorts of regulation are what's reshaping the financial and economic orders. You know, if we talk about China as an international actor that's changing or challenging international order, you can't. There's not a singular actor, there's sub-state, provincial, et cetera. So, you know, so that's obvious. But again, in the realm of systemic challenges too, if we're dealing with pandemics, climate change, and so on, so it's very obvious that we're definitely have to foreground transnational actors in the international system. So yes, it's a bit of a bad reflection on the state of certainly maybe our conversation, but maybe the broader IR conversations as a whole, that's not getting more airplay than what we may be seeing.
Well, that 30 seconds is more airplay than I think you see, generally speaking, in the pages of Foreign Affairs.
Well, first of all, I was not in graduate school in 1995, but it's as you guys have all confessed that you are. You all look fantastic for that. And for you all talking about me being the young up and comer here, all I've been doing is watching the feed and literally counting the number of new gray hairs I can see on my head in the feed. So you know, age is just the construct, I think. I will admit, Dan, that my own work on and conceptualization of order has been very state centric so far. I think I agree with you that disparate actors, non-state actors, need to have a role in a conception, a complete conception of order. I would say where I do that, or where I think there is room for that, is in like the membership principles or the membership rules. I think maybe what Evelyn was talking about, like the social structure, who's in and who's out. And in practice, in my own work, I've just used that to refer to what kinds of states are in and out. But I think that could be extended to membership about whether, disparate unit types are allowed into an order or not. And I will just say that Dan, in reading and teaching your own recent Exit from Hegemony book, I thought you did a nice job of bringing transnational civil society into a conception of of the liberal international order, and trying to figure out, bringing that in as another element of the exceptional nature of the liberal international order in a way that I hadn't really thought about before. And I do think that I'd have to do more thinking about it, but the adaptability of the liberal order to include all of these different aspects of transnational civil society seems to be perhaps one of its unique properties that, you know, prior to your work at least, hasn't been emphasized enough in the liberal order debate.
Stacey, do you have anything you
I think this is an excellent question. And I think what a lot of the comments from Evelyn and Kyle are getting at is the fact that the process of ordering is in many ways a process of social closure. So it's not surprising in many ways that some of these actors disappear, even though they don't disappear, right? They're having these really important causal effects, but they disappear because they're not given the authority or legitimacy to engage in this type of ordering process. And it's funny because, I mean, obviously we were not only in grad school at the same time, Dan, but in the same place. You know, I agree that we had some of this work, like sports work, for example, that was talking about these constitutive principles. But the first thing I thought of when thinking about discussions of order in the 1990s was the first round, or maybe it was the second round, who knows, of the Concert of Europe debates. Was it an order? Did it matter? Was it just balance of power? Yada, 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 right? And one thing, having like revisiting concert stuff recently, is how much revolutionary actors and nationalist actors, like these transnational networks, just disappear from these debates. It's all about the states. And you know what? That's exactly what Metternich wanted to happen, right? Is for these transnational actors to disappear. So in some ways, we're telling the story that was told. Like, so it's for me, I absolutely agree that in some ways you need to recapture that, but there's a reason that we end up slipping so easily into this, because we understand the narrative of social closure.
Yeah, I mean, this is what I have to say about the grand strategy debates about Habsburg Spain, right? Is that you have all these discussions about strategic overextension by the Spanish, where there's a sort of sometimes a little bit of acknowledgement. Well, there's some like religious stuff going on that might have something to do with this, but a complete lack of kind of acknowledgement that the reason the 80 Years' War is a sustainable endeavor against the Spanish is because of transnational religious movements and transnational religious support. In fact, the reason for the Spanish Armada is to cut off English support for the Dutch rebels. This has been a fantastic conversation. I really appreciate your coming on. I want to ask if you have any final words or final thoughts that you want to share with the audience. I'm getting some shaking heads, but so you were academics. Somebody's got to have something that they feel like they have to get off their proverbial chest.
I just want to say thank you for bringing us all together on this. Like it is amazing to sit with scholars whose work I admire so much on order and have this type of exchange. So I'm not going to cloud it up with one more academic comment. I'm just going to say thank you.
Me too. Thank you so much. I've really, really enjoyed this much, much more than I thought I would. Thank you.
I genuinely enjoy this. This is a real delight and a lot of fun, and actually very productive for my own thinking. My only other thought is, hey, some generous benefactor out there listening to this podcast, maybe we need a Journal of International Order Studies. Can we work on that? Thanks.
I've been working for years on how we might create a recursive journal name with a not international organization title. And what I've settled on is international order in some respects. Well, thank you so much for coming on. This has been a delight for me because I just mostly had to sit here and drink and listen to you talk, which is the best way to do this. And thanks for coming on. And I hope that in some capacity, we can see you again or listen to you again.